This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Andre Van was always drawn to the front porch where adults were telling stories and rocking in their chairs. As a little boy, he was enchanted with tales of the past and loved learning about his family's history. That history was all around him. He lived in a tight-knit community founded by his great-great-grandmother in Henderson, North Carolina. His neighbors were his extended family and friends. Andre took his passion for the past and turned it into a career, and he's now coordinator of university archives at North Carolina Central University, also an instructor of public history there, and my guest today on the State of Things. Andre Van, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Frank. So glad to be here. Wonderful.
Tell us about this community where you grew up in the Mobile neighborhood or section of Henderson, North Carolina.
Yeah, well, Mobile was in the, still is, in the southern part of Vance County, southern part of Henderson. Very small but yet quiet place, as we always like to say. Had two churches, by the way. Had four stores, and our grocery store was one of them. My great uncle lived up the street. He owned the other one, by the way. And several of my father's good friends who were businessmen. And one elementary school, the Lely Bianca Elementary School, named for an African-American, one of the first jeans teachers there, who's a family friend, by the way. And the school, by the way, located on Hawkins Drive, named my mother's family. And so it's a part of that sense of what I call rootedness, you know, a real sense of place. Mobile, it was one where, you know, you had these elders, these community persons, you know, much like almost in Africa, where you had, you know, certain chiefs then and certain elders who were given sort of that level of authority to sort of help make the decision for the community at large. So it was one community I've been very proud of because nothing but relatives.
And it is a community that is more like a neighborhood. I mean, it's in the city. We're not talking about a rural area with extended family living, you know, in far distant places. You're living on streets and you got, as you say, a couple of stores. But this sense of community rooted in the elders and their stories and their rules. Right. And you apparently were somebody who liked to hang out with those folks while everybody else was running away,
right.
trying to get as far away from the old folks as possible. You were hanging around listening.
I just thought it was just always important to sort of gather these stories and narratives because, you know, I was surrounded by not just relatives, but lots of older community persons, elders, you know, who had all these stories to tell. I always say they had stories. They were pregnant with opportunities, you know, for listening. And I was just sort of always glad to sort of be there. And it came through interactions, whether I was visiting a relative or delivering groceries somewhere, or sometimes people would come by to see us and would sit on the front porch. And you just have opportunity to sort of listen, and that's one thing about me. You know, I think that's what will keep me to 100, age of 100, is always being curious. And you know, and I was so curious about hearing them sort of explain and sort of tell these stories. You know, and I think that kind of it drives me even today. To sort of have the chance to sort of hear from right. persons sharing these stories.
Well, many of those stories go back to your great-great-grandmother, who was a landowner, and essentially it was her, you're living on her land, right?
Right.
And subdivided. Well, tell us about her and how she came to own land back then in the middle of the 19th century.
Well, great-great-grandmother, Rebecca Hawkins, she was a housemaid in the home of Colonel John Davis Hawkins, who was rumored to be her father, by the way. Have a picture of her, you know, and a narrative about her. And yet there she was given certain responsibilities and duties and none more important, you know, in during the institution of slavery than to be a midwife. To deliver the children. And then post-emancipation, she continued that craft and that trade of delivering, as the her obituary, published in 1901, by the way, says that she was known in and out of the each and every home, white and black, because she delivered the majority of the babies in the city. And so she would sometimes take those little small earnings. And I will say, she was not not literate in the sense of knowing how to even write. But I told folk one thing about her. She knew how to count. So she always had money. And she was able to take those coins and she received certain properties along the Southern Railroad where the Hawkins family had owned much of the land after they moved to Wake County over to Raleigh. And so what she was able to do was take what little earnings she had and purchase up these little bits and pieces of that land. And then she did something kind of unique, right? We're talking about the 1890s. She then conveyed the deeds to my great-grandfather and all his other siblings. There were 11 who remained black. There were 10 who disappeared, we're told, into the white world. We never saw another day of our life. And so I told folks she was building expectations, you know, expectations not just for them, but for the next generation, because they could never sell those properties. They had to convey them to their children. So here it is, a woman who, you know, had limited literary skills, but had a wonderful business acumen and was smart enough to know that this land could never be sold. And so the property we have today, the deed, goes back to the 1890s.
And a difficult time for black women to be owning land and keeping it. It's one thing to be able to buy it, but we know what went on in that period, particularly after Reconstruction, when the land was being taken back through all kinds of underhanded means by white landowners. So the fact that she could buy it and keep it, pretty incredible.
Indeed. But it also speaks to, I think, the sort of revered role and place that she had. And like I said, she really taught, I think, her children to sort of go along with the same aspect, the idea of creating their own, having their own. And so that community we call Mobile, you know, that is so emblematic of that work that she believed in, that you own your own, even in the midst of segregation, even in the midst of Jim Crow, where you are your own owner and your own consumers, and then create institutions that are sturdy. And she did that as well.
How much of this did you learn through your research, and how much of it came through the narratives, and what were people saying? What did you hear on the porch about your great-great-grandmother?
I was lucky. Right up the street from me, we call her Aunt Beck, who was the namesake of her grandmother. Her name was Rebecca as well. And she too was a midwife, you know, the second generation of midwives, lived right up the street. And it was years, I told folks, before I even knew that, that was actually my grandfather's first cousin. And so, but the closeness of that was that, you know, we always considered them my aunt, so it was no problem. And so they would always sort of invite me up to the front porch, sit out there and sort of tell these stories. But more importantly, they would, you know, when I would go inside the homes and I would look on the walls, and you're talking about understanding that question of rootedness, that sense of place, and understanding, seeing on the walls many of my ancestors hanging on the walls. I said that was quite impressionable upon me. It gave me a real appreciation for identity, a sense of place from whence I had come. And I told folks it was one of the most empowering things I think I probably ever understood, that they understood the connection that, you know, as Mary McLeod Bethune said, my people will never be satisfied until they see black faces in high places. Well, they had mastered that long ago, because I saw that on the wall.
And for you, this was the place where you grew up. So I'm wondering if you knew anything else, if you knew what other families might have been missing, in other words.
Yeah, well, I told her, you know, coming from a large family, you know, I felt sorry for those who didn't have a large family like mine, because we were full of so many good stories, so many connections. But yet we still had interaction with a world outside of ours.
Well, your father owned a grocery store and was a union leader.
Yeah, well, we would call it like our store, Van's Grocery and Fish Market. It had been around for 40 years. And truth be told, the advertisement, even we had on the local radio station, WIZS, was that we had the coldest beer in town. And so people always come to see us, none personal. And they would always come to see us to hear and talk about all that was going on. So our store was sort of like a trading post, you know, where people would come in, purchase goods, and we sold everything there, everything on to hair care products. We sold it all, cigarettes, you name it. And so but it was there that I had a chance to see and understand, you know, really, you know, that we were connected to a much larger world than ourselves. You know, although we were safe and secure in our little place there, there were always people externally coming, internally coming into our place. And we learned a lot, and they learned a lot from us, too.
Talk about your father's work as a labor leader in the AFL-CIO.
Yeah, my father spent 25 years working for the Tobacco Workers Union, largely. The AFL-CIO had to travel a lot, always kind of negotiating for the employees at the J.P. Taylor Tobacco Company. There were two main industries in our community, outside of little small, those who had certain skill sets. The India Tobacco, India Mill, as well as the J.P. Taylor Tobacco Company, started out in about 1904. And so it was one of the largest employers of African Americans in not just in Mobile, but also in the area. And so my father was sort of given his task outside of running a grocery store to sort of help be the leader, you know, for this organization, which, by the way, was made up of mostly women, by the way. Let me just tell you. And yet they entrusted him to sort of lead them and negotiate for them for their basic rights there at the J.P. Taylor Tobacco Factory. And so that didn't come easy because, you know, he had to face a lot of, a little minor intimidation every now and then. But because we own our own grocery store, that kind of aided us and assisted us. And
how
also,
do you think, forgive me for interrupting, but why do you think owning the grocery store gave him the leverage to overcome or at least face down some of that intimidation?
Well, it gave us a sense of independence. That was a key. Right. Yeah. We were not dependent upon anyone else to sort of direct for us what our needs would be and how they would be met. We created our own.
It also gave him a little political power as a labor leader.
Gave him quite a bit of political power as well. I always tell folk when, you know, every time there was an election coming around, we're talking about over, you know, the span of about 20 or 25 years, there were always people coming by to see him.
White and black?
White and black. And let me just tell you something. And his name was Cecil. You know, so they always come by and bring him little gifts and, you know, cookies. Oh, my wife made these cookies. You know, I'm just sitting there dying laughing in the back because I know why you're here. You're coming back here because he was in charge of the South Henderson number 2 voting precinct. And so, you know, so you had to get his support if you wanted to win, right? And it worked. And so yet, so very interesting sort of see how he was sort of able to maneuver around. But I'll tell you one quick funny story.
I tell you what, hold that quick funny story because I do want to have it when we return to the sure. State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. The funny story that Andre Van is about to tell, you will hear after these messages. So please come back. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio talking to Andre Van today, who learned all about his family's history as a boy and then just kept learning. Most of that he grew up with on the land, in fact, that his family had owned for generations. Father owned a store there, was a union and a labor representative, as well as a store owner, and that brought a lot of politicians to the front door with gifts.
Right.
It's a lot of fun. So you were about to tell the story before the break.
Yeah, well, that was one story I know that kind of really stands out. I think I've only told it once. And the story was about, you know, the sheriff, you know, they hold a lot of power. In little small counties and towns. And yet my father had two friends who were running for sheriff. You know, the current one who he had endorsed and then a very good friend of his who was endorsed. And so he was caught in this question, you know, okay, so which will he sort of support? And so he had to make what I call a very courageous decision. He merely found two young men and on the election day because whoever he had out there, if he wasn't out there, that's who he supported. Yeah. That's who usually won. And so he actually had to put out two young men to sort of help put out for both because he didn't know who was going to win. Wow. And they could have an impact on his business. And he was smart enough to understand that, right? and understand that, okay, you can't, you know, you have to be friends with both because you never know who the next sheriff will be. And so luckily, either one of you.
So he's it's like supporting the camp. So he supported the campaign of both.
Both, right.
That's great. And did it work out? I mean,
it worked out. But both remained his friends.
Wow.
Including one who became the sheriff. And so, wow. So that was important, you know, and it gave me, I think, a window into understanding sometimes his sense of diplomacy that he had to make in these little small little towns where you have to navigate. You have safe security in your community, but you also understand that you're a part of a much larger place and a much larger world. And some external factors like, you know, the sheriff and his role in all about our community, that's important.
Well, and race relations, which is another complication that he would have to navigate. What were they like generally? You talk about things being, you know, within your neighborhood and the comfort and the confidence that you felt there. You were landowners, you had property and business. Did you have a sense of what was going on around you where things were not that good?
Well, I would tell you, as Charles Dickens would say, a tale of two cities, right? One where the year in which I was born, classic example, 1970, I had to deliver a talk up there a few weeks ago, and I was reminded, and I reminded the community that here was, I was reading in the New York Times in the year that I was born, 1970, that the National Guard had been brought into my little town, this little quiet town where they told me we never had problems. We all kind of worked together. We worked on our issues. We had our own communities. They were brought in because the schools were slow to desegregate and start trying to find ways to integrate. And so the African-American community, they weren't putting up with it, and they had had enough. And so here we go, coming and reading the New York Times. The local papers covered a little bit, but it was the New York Times that found this story so interesting that the state troopers had to be brought in because the African Americans, there was unrest all throughout the neighborhood. And so then when you look at the 70s and 80s, the time in which I'm coming of age, some call it the Second Reconstruction, because in essence what they were trying to do was maintain and keep the gains that they had made over the course of the 50s and 60s. And so it's what I think Dr. Jacqueline Dahl Hall over at UNC Chapel Hill, she called this period, which I so very much embrace. She said, when you look at the civil rights movement, we think about it from 1954 with the Brown versus Board of Education decision, 1968, the death of Dr. King. Well, she said that, you know, you have to look at what we call that long civil rights movement, that there were activities prior to that. There were activities after that period. And I have clear evidence and proof that there were activists operating within the scope of our community well before 54 and well after the 1970s, in which I was born.
So clearly history has always been interesting to you, whether it's Stories on the Porch or whether it is diving into the archives and the writings of scholars that you've just quoted. When did you decide to make this a career?
I think the career chose me. I think that's the best way to look at it. Having that experience of growing up in that community and sort of being embraced with that history and that culture and past and understanding really my sense of place, you know, just like I tell the students I teach at North Carolina Central University, I tell them the same thing. I said, you know, if you want to be empowered, then you have to know who you are. If you don't know who you are, how can you tell anyone else who they are? And so that sense of empowerment, you know, was important for me, and it's something I share. And so I say all that to say that early background, that early training of sort of moving, operating within the framework of my community and then outside that community, you know, really prepared me for a life. I knew I would be in education. My mother's family had been in education going back almost three generations as well. And so that kind of cemented for me that, you know, I have, there's something here, and that also that history is all about us, and it's all intertwined in our life. No matter where we move, history has a place. And I knew that that I could sort of have a way to sort of contribute to that history by, some would say, kind of writing people into history. And that's sort of what I like to do, write people into history that whose narrative and story sometimes has not always been told. But yet we know one of the most important areas of history, especially when it relates to scholar research, is the history of African-American life and history. That's something I know a little something about. And so so people always want to know, how do people live, work, and play? Those are the three critical questions that you have to ask when you research and engage in with research and scholars.
Although for a long time, history was not that. History was the story of people who were in power and perhaps how they got to power and how they fell from power,
indeed,
but how other people lived, worked, and played, and the dynamics that went on to allow for all that to happen didn't make its way into the history books.
Exactly. And it showed that, you know, I operate under a system. I teach it every semester. I use the pyramid as a classic example. Right. And I always tell my students, I say, well, you know, at the top of that pyramid, you have that 10%. That 10%, these are going to be people always talk about. They always will be known to the public, always known to the world. But yet within the majority, at the end of that, is that 90%. That richness, that sense of opportunity, that again, pregnant opportunity that exists there to help tell the stories of those, how they moved about, how they crafted their lives, even in the midst of emancipation, Jim Crow, segregation, post-desegregation, and really delving into that world. And scholars have sort of validated that.
Well, it seems to me the power of that works in two directions. Number one, it helps us better understand how that 10% got there, what they were looking at, and
right,
what kinds of dynamics that they were having to navigate. So we have a better understanding of that. But also, When you talked about the neighborhood you came from, the sense of power, empowerment that you had, and a sense of confidence, if you weren't born in that neighborhood, what does that mean? And so then maybe knowing that there is a history that you have not been told and understanding that you were part of that history, that can at least create a kind of a historic neighborhood for you if you didn't grow up in that household.
Yeah, well, let me just tell you something. People are always curious. I get calls. A lot of times I get more calls sometimes in a doctor's office. People who want to know about certain bits and pieces of history. And so you find that the work that I'm engaging in today, you know, is what will be history some for tomorrow, but it's also part of the present. But yet there are people, family members, persons who are doing research who have found this, the history, especially history of African-American life and history, one of the most unique and yet fascinating areas of research that is still yet not at the margins where you can sort of safely sit back and rest and say, oh, yeah, all the stories have been told. Because there's still stories to tell.
Talk about your decision to go to NC Central to do your undergraduate.
Well, I'll tell you, it was one of the most unique experiences, I think, in preparation for going. I always knew I was going to go to college. My father, he wanted me to stay behind and run the family grocery store. Because I had three brothers, by the way, all with degrees in business. All three of them. But not one of them wanted to come back and run the store. And so there I was, and I was, you know, under a lot of tremendous pressure to decide whether or not this is what I want to do. But my mother came in, and she made it simple and plain. She said, oh, no, you're going to school. You're going to college. And North Carolina Central University had already been our place. My great uncle, Asker Boyd Hawkins, who was a mathematician, by the way, graduated from there in 1933. And he set the standard. And so from there, we had about 60 or 65 other relatives go there. And I knew it was a safe place, good place for me, right up the road, and wonderful history, wonderful past. And then my family doctor, his wife, Miss Carolyn Green, was the granddaughter of Dr. Shepherd. So Dr. James Shepherd, who founded North Carolina Central University. And so that was an even greater connection. And so once I came here in 1988 as a freshman, among the first things I did, besides sort of moving around the campus, was get registered to vote. That was the first thing. And that's the activism on the part of the university and students there to make sure that we were part of the larger community. Once I arrived here, I was just still impressed as well with the same sense of culture, sense of place and history and heritage that I had experienced back home in Henderson and Mobile.
I was going to ask you if it felt if you felt any way dislocated having to move out of that enclave in Mobile to Durham.
Well, I was lucky. You know, my parents had friends here. We had lots of relatives who were already here. We had people who were my great aunts and uncles who they socialized with, who would come from Durham to Henderson, and those from Henderson would come up to Durham. So, and let me just tell you also, almost all of our insurance was held by North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, by the way. So I told folk in our grocery store, we had those beautiful, wonderful heritage calendars they had hanging on the wall. So I had a chance to sort of see some of this history's kind of come alive, and it kind of prepared me for that journey there.
And Durham's history is an interesting history in and of itself that has much of what you described in Mobile. A lot of those communities had some of the similar experiences.
Just on a larger scale.
Yeah.
But it was larger what we call self-image and self-representation. The idea of understanding that the narratives that we had heard about Durham and even back home in Henderson, that there were stories that rest behind the narrative that existed there. And then when the realities come in, where you get a chance to really see how individuals were able to sort of make a world unto themselves, really, in order to survive. That to me was rich because it told me that African Americans were not just placed in one box and said, stay in this box, that they jumped out the box and they worked beyond that.
You went to NC Central for your undergrad, and then there was a question of what you were going to do for postgraduate. So talk about those decisions and where you ended up.
Oh, yeah. Well, did my undergraduate work there in 1993, surrounded by a great group of faculty members there, great institution that, really helped to ingrain you in history and it's all this great fascinating parts of it. But yet at the same time, I said, well, what will I do? But that was pretty easy. Since I was right there at the university, they said, well, the university had a very good track record of sending persons forward to get not just the master's but the PhD. And so I was glad to sort of be a part of that and transition well right into the master's program there. And never regretted one moment because I had a chance then to understand, on a much higher level, you know, how history comes alive. And so one of the most interesting courses I ever took, I had the opportunity to take, was looking at Jim Crow. And that for me helped to bring alive very much all that I had heard about, all that I had encountered, because that course was taught between NCCU and Duke University. No one else in the South had even started thinking about teaching such a course. And I was glad to be one of the participants in that.
And then you went to, you were thinking about a PhD.
Right.
And then you looked at the price tag.
Right. Yeah, but, no, prior, but prior to that, I had had very good exposure of a wonderful internship. And that internship helped to sort of seep into my mind a possibly a different way of sort of looking at history. Mm-hmm. And so I had an opportunity to intern at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library. Mm. And I reminded folks, I said, well, you know, in our home we had hanging on the wall, John F. Kennedy, Dr. Martin Luther King, and Jesus Christ. Those were the three. My parents' home, my grandparents' home, yeah. My sister and brother, twins, John and Joan, named for the John F. Kennedy, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I ended up at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library there, and I had a chance to work on the papers of Nicholas de Belleville Katzenbach. And who was Attorney General. You know, if you see that tall, lanky fellow standing in the schoolhouse door with Governor Wallace, mm-hmm. that was Nicholas de Belleville Katzenbach, Attorney General. And so for me, I said, well, here's another avenue. Here's another way to sort of help cull and tell the story by preserving for another generation these records and papers. And so I moved into, graduated from the master's program in 1995, went directly on faculty there, teaching the history department there as well as Shaw, and then wondered about this question of a PhD. Was accepted in Howard and Morgan. As I say, as you aptly said, I saw that bill and I said, oh no, you know, I early on knew that maybe there's another way to do this. And so I was able then to sort of look at the opportunity of sort of getting another education, but getting it right here in the state of North Carolina.
You went to NC State.
Went to NC State, got into the public history program. The university at that time, the NCSU had offered a few courses, but you had to go to North Carolina State to take most of the classes through the library science program. And so I went to North Carolina State University, studied under the great John David Smith, studied under David Olson, who was a state historian, by the way, Dick Langford. All of them, by the way, will be in town next week for an association meeting we have here. And so I had a chance to sort of study under the best about archives. They sort of wanted me to get the full other master's, and I reminded them, I said, well, I already have a master's degree, and I was teaching at two universities. So I was like, well, thank you.
Where were you teaching?
I was teaching here at North Carolina State University, but also at Shaw University.
At Shaw, yeah.
Teaching North Carolina history, U.S. history, African-American history. And so I knew that if I wanted to be powerful, I had to have a degree in history, but I also had to have this training in public history. And so North Carolina State really helped sort of fill
that. And what do you
mean?
What does that mean, public history? What do you mean when
The idea of looking at history outside of the normal setting, meaning you don't have to just teach in a public school, although it's wonderful to be a teacher, but there are other avenues, such as being an archivist, being an interpreter at a historic site, by the way, to work for the government. But the idea of you looking at and sort of using history, but looking at it in different professions in different ways to sort of engage with the public and give back to the public its own history and its past. And so that, for me, really helped to come alive. It's something I really wanted to do.
And eventually became the archivist for the university at North Carolina University. So what does that job involve?
Well, first of all, it's a blessed position. I had the privilege of studying under Mr. B.T. McMillan. He was a gentleman who founded the first university archives there. And so the idea of the archives is the idea of preserving not just the university history, but also the community history and understanding our very unique role and place in the community. And that can't just be based on oral history. It has to be based on something. And that is what we call, the historians call it the stuff of life, you know, the historical records and papers to help them record and tell the story for other generations to come.
And that is an important story. I mean, I think for perhaps any university, but an HBCU, and particularly one like NCCU, its story and its place in the Durham community and also its place in higher education. I mean, talk about the way those things come together when it comes to just North Carolina Central.
Right. Well, that history and the story and narrative all comes together. A large upon this idea of understanding, that, you know, university, North Carolina Central University is one of, 104, some say maybe 105 overall historically black colleges and universities, called HBCUs. And so, yet, we have a very unique history. Beginning in 1925, the state made us, came in and provided legislation to support it, and made then Early University the nation's first state-supported liberal arts institution in the entire United States of America. And that's a point of pride for us. But it also said that we didn't, you know, it was that great to have that history, great to have that heritage, but that wasn't where we were going to stay. And so the university has sort of widened our views and our options to sort of meet the very critical needs that exist there through research institutes, through our library science program, through our law school, sort of helping to round out, you know, this the college experience for those who come there. That they're not just coming there to receive just a degree. They're coming there for a life of service and understand the very important role that this university history and heritage plays, but also understanding that they have opportunity through our university. The motto of truth and service, the idea of giving back to those who have done for them.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. In this current moment, the value of HBCUs, the question frequently comes up, and I'll put it to you, if they are still relevant today and still as useful today as they were once.
Yeah, well, I always say that each and every historic Black college university is but but the footprint of the community in which they reside and exist in. If you really want to understand, and most folk never look at historic Black college university in this way. You know, they always think about the course offering or the size of the population. But the one thing that they always overlook is what I call the impact. And that is the financial impact of that historic Black college university. North Carolina example, of all the HBCUs, there are six that are public, five that are private or denominational. But yet, if you look at that impact, we're talking about overall, based on studies that have been done, $1.6, some say $1.7 billion impact on the local communities in which they engaged in. And that tells you that, you know, we're not just in the business of just educating the students, but we're also helping them to sort of be engaged in the communities in which they live, to get the great internships, to also then, once they receive those degrees, then to be of service to those in their community. And that is part of what I call the DNA. Yeah. Not just of North Carolina Central University, but probably of almost every HBCU, understanding their relevancy and certainly their place.
Andre Van is coordinator of the archives at North Carolina Central University, also an instructor of public history, and we will talk more about his life as we continue on The State of Things. Do stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow talking to Andre Van today, rooted in history, and those roots run deep. Grew up in a tight-knit community founded by his great-great-grandmother. As a boy, enchanted by stories of the past, turned that passion into his life's work. Now the coordinator of archives at North Carolina Central University, teaches public history at the university, and you really love funerals.
I must say, many might not find the field of research into the lives of Black funeral homes and morticians in general, or funerals, but I find them quite unique, and I really love that area of research.
Why?
But let me just tell you something. None more respected in the African American community than after the family, African American family, after the Black church, and certainly the preacher, than that of and education, of course, than that of the mortician. They just kind of hold a very revered place. In my church back home in Henderson, we had two funeral homes morticians who were funeral home directors who resided in our church. My father's good friend, who, by the way, helped him with voter registration drives, was Mr. Allen Williams, Williams Funeral Home up there, who was largely involved in that. And so this is what I saw. And so you get a chance to understand that, you know, they're called upon at unique times in the lives of individuals. And most folk may not have interaction with them, but yet it is so interesting to see how these independent, and that's the difference between Black morticians and other business leaders. They were independent because they were solely responsible for themselves, and yet they were supported and buoyed by the African American community. And that is this on down to today, where you have this very critical role of African Americans assisting almost every aspect of human life within the African American community. And that's so important.
Not only the professional service, but you say an important role in philanthropy in Black communities.
Yeah, I gave a talk just a few weeks ago at the Black Communities Conference. And we had a wonderful audience there who wanted to, you know, they were kind of curious about, well, you're talking about Black funeral home. So I said, well, I created a very unique title, which was, "We Will Be the Last Ones to Let You Down." And most folks think that, you know, we were talking about the funeral aspect of mm-hmm. that. I was talking about the philanthropic work, whereupon they are called upon by the community I use examples of everything from people want to borrow chairs to people wait for the first of the year for the calendars to come out. The churches working hand in hand. Sometimes if you're at home with the fans, I said it's not by accident, right? Yesterday I was in two services and there you go, church fans still in their use with the funeral home emblazed on it. And so you understand that unique place and role that existed there. But then you also understand how, for instance, I'll never forget, over at LSD Jones Funeral Home, Miss Nellie Taylor Jones, who passed just a few years ago, provide a very critical service in the community. She understood, you know, at the LSD Jones Funeral Home, LSD Jones and Sons Funeral Home, which is in its fourth generation, the very unique place in that community in Northeast Central Durham. And so she created, helped to create, along with the mothers of murdered children here in Durham, a very unique service. And I said, well, here it is. You know, she didn't have to do that.
What was the service?
The idea of bringing together the mothers of murdered children here in Durham. That was the title of the organization that she helped to form and found.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that about until the day of her funeral. And I said, wow, how could that have happened and we not know, you know, her role? I knew about the organization, but I didn't know her connection there. You know, and understanding that, you know, when you're bringing people together to sort of solve some of the very critical issues that are there, that's important. Scarborough Funeral Home, old man J.C. Scarborough Sr., you know, first licensed funeral director and embalming in the entire state of North Carolina dating back to 1905, but yet was able to take the resources that he had. And if you go along Favor Street, you get a chance to see the Scarborough Mansion. You get a chance to understand, you know, the import of that. But then also you understand that he helped to found the Daisy Hargett Scarborough Nursery, you know, at a critical time to allow African-American women during the 1930s to be able to be engaged in the world of work by having a safe place to bring their children. Well, these are kind of hidden stories. You know, we see them as the mortician coming to pick up the body, coming to do the service for the body, but we don't think about or look at the other underlying aspects of their life, working in and out of the community, being called upon, and almost civil rights leaders, some as well, playing in that because of their level of independence and not relying upon the outside world except for those within the community.
Level of independence and the intimate connection they have with the families, you know, in their most vulnerable moments. So this is when you really know the families that you're connected with in that community. And you get to know every single one of them, right? Because they're all going to cross your doorstep.
Indeed. And they know the families better than anyone else, almost. And they are holders. That was a part of the presentation, the fact that the Black African-American Funeral Home, they are the holders of a lot of this history, and this history sometimes is lost. But classic example, Brown's Funeral Home in Warrenton called me. Miss Brown called me and said, "Well, we're closing up after 60 years, and we want to deposit with you all of our historical material about the Brown's Funeral Home that was in Northeast North Carolina."
Yeah.
And yet I had a chance to see not only in terms of about 1,000 funeral programs, these rich histories and narratives of people who had lived there going back 3 and 4 generations in which they were the funeral home of record. But also, you know, she gave me a tour of the place, you know, and there were certain rooms I wanted to go into and certain rooms I didn't. But I learned a lot about how uniquely they were seen and viewed in that community.
Is
and they
this
were seen
a specialty now, or is this something that you're going to carve out as a specialty to taking a look at these in a more systematic way?
Yeah. Yes, we are. We're building a very large collection for future purposes, for genealogy. That is the main thing. These funeral programs provide a glimpse into someone's life that otherwise you might not get anywhere else. Sometimes maybe the only time someone might write about it, even talk about someone's story. And so we're building a wonderful database that will have all of these funeral programs alphabetized. And so people can sort of come there, and we're called upon all the time to sort of scan away a copy of a funeral program about someone's life.
You get called on to do eulogies. You're getting so good.
Indeed. well, and that sort of goes back to the idea of, as when I was much younger and smaller and sitting on those front porches. And sometimes they would tell the young kids, other young kids, okay, you know, we're talking, go away, but they would let me stay. And so you get a chance sort of sometimes to learn to not talk, but listen. Listen to people sharing their narrative and sharing these stories. And I think that's the richness. That's what people are yearning for even today. There's a whole world of people who are ready to read about and most importantly, buy scholarly works that are by and about the lives of African-Americans. And that's important. being able to listen to these stories. And I'm so glad I was given the opportunity and privilege when I was younger to get there.
So these are the very personal stories that you're talking about, stories that have been left out of our history and that form the base of this pyramid that you talk about when it comes to understanding history. Now we see the New York Times with its 1619 project trying to fill in some of the gaps. What do you think about that project?
I think the 1619 Project is one that, and especially the wonderful magazine that was sent out. I think the Washington Post has just come out with another piece as well. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that one yet. But that that edition, that very special story about the 400th anniversary of the presence of blacks or Africans or African Americans in America, I think is something that 20 to 30 years from now will be a wonderful historical marker along the highway of sort of recording during this very important year the significance and the impact, but yet then raises many important questions for the modern world, not just the history, you know. Right. As we say, history is a nice place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there, you know. And right. So you get a chance to understand, you know, the modernity, the modernness of the very critical issues facing African Americans today. And so I'm appreciative of that work. And I have to thank the New York Times because they sent to North Carolina Central University and every historically black college and university 2,000 copies. And before, say, less than three weeks later, almost every edition was almost gone.
Yeah. And as you say, it's about bringing the story forward and understanding. And I think it has provided a deeper understanding for why we are where we are today and how much of what happened 400 years ago is still living with us today. That legacy is not something that's in the past.
Yeah, and yet it brings about, if nothing else, opportunity for conversations. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the hope and idea. And we here in Durham and North Carolina State University and others will be, so along with Stanford at Warren Branch Library, we'll have sort of working on ways to sort of have conversation around these works to help people to understand that, this 400th anniversary, yeah, that year is important. But yet there are systematic issues that have to be addressed and should be talked about if you want to get to some of the root causes and issues that are so very prevalent in the African American community, internal as well as external. That's important.
You've written a number of books about African American history in North Carolina, many of them centered in photographs. Talk about those books and the importance of the photographs.
Yeah, well, I've been privileged to have authored four books looking at Vance County, my hometown. Started out in 1999, actually, with Durham's Hayti, which this December will be 20 years still in print, still available. Wow. Thank goodness. Along with looking at Sedalia and Pottermore Institute, staying for this little town, my cousin founded her private school, Pottermore Institute. Oldest black prep school in the country.
And tell us where that is.
In Sedalia, North Carolina. We call it on the old Burlington Highway, 70, as they call it. It's a little small town called Sedalia, North Carolina. And so there, my cousin founded the Pottermore Institute, again, dating back to 1902. She went to New England, came back as a missionary in 1901, and in 1902 established her school there. In 2017, I authored African Americans of Durham County. And so I use photographs as a very visual manner and way to sort of help tell the story of how African American lives have unfolded in the past. And again, it sort of gets back to the idea of self-image and self-representation. I told folk, just imagine, when I look at photographs from the 1880s and 1890s, I told them they are just as revolutionary as someone holding a gun because they push back against the notion, the ideas that have been built up, that African Americans, though seen then as second-class citizens, not deserving of basic human rights and dignity, but yet they are able to take these photographs and yet convey to a much larger world this presence, who they are in photographs. And that's something you can't get sometimes in writing, but the photographs help to tell the stories of that self-image and self-representation and the power that comes along with that to inspire a person. Again, I grew up looking at my ancestors hanging on the walls in my home. You come to my home today, you will see my ancestors when guests and visitors and friends come hanging up on my walls because, you know, it's a point of pride for me, and I know it's a point of pride for others as well.
And some of those people may not be well known to everybody else, but one of those ancestors you talked about was the founder of that school, Charlotte Hawkins Brown, right?
Right.
Who's somebody that who is well known or should be well known in North Carolina history.
Yeah, well she's someone whose history had at one point in time been lost to history. She died in 1961. She's born in 1883 in Mobile, in the community about a street over from where I was born. And I was born at home, by the way, if I didn't know, didn't say by a midwife, by the way. And she was born, like I said, one block over on Hawkins Drive today. And so she was among that group, though, that migrated to Cambridge and Boston, Massachusetts during the 1890s. And yet, after she got her education there, decided to come back home, right, and came back home as a missionary. Under the AMA, American Missionary Association, to establish or help support a school there in the Sedalia community to give education to those in that little small rural outlying area there. And so, but what she found was a school in disarray, in shambles, financially not supportive. And the missionary, American Missionary Association, really left her in the dust, as we would say. And so she went back to New England, raised money. Came across the life and work of one who would be her great sponsor and one who would be her great supporter. And that of course, was Alice Freeman Palmer, who first was president of Wellesley College. And so with that help of those New England families, those many wealthy white New England families who sent funds down for her established school, from there, education started there. For the first time in that area. But then by the 1930s, she helped create a public school there and then turned her school then into a private school in the 1930s. And she still relied upon white philanthropy to support institutions, could teach classes, by the way, on how you engage persons for a cause that you believe in. And she believed in that cause for over 51 years up until her death.
A missionary in both directions.
In both directions.
Educating the folks in New England, what was going on down here, and then bringing all that back and creating a new kind of wealth in these communities in North Carolina. What's going on with you now? What are some of the projects you're working on?
Well, I have about two projects I'm working on. One will look at the role. Of course, I'm still kind of continuing that research and looking at the role of black funeral homes. So I'm still working on that as a much more larger project.
I'm going to interrupt your narrative right here to talk about the fact that I understand that you're actually considering becoming a funeral director.
Oh yeah, we left that little part out. Yes, Started in the spring. My cousins in Henderson run a funeral home. And my father inspired them to create their funeral home. And so from time to time, I always get called upon to write an obituary to help put a little program together for someone's life. And so for me, it just almost became natural, the idea of saying, well, you know, here's something that, I'm going to keep my day job. Let me just tell you that, keep my day job. Okay. But at the same time, to sort of acquire that license to sort of be able to assist where possible. Mm-hmm. And it's something that, you know, it's not meant for everyone. But those that are committed to it, it's something I think, once you're in it, you'll never leave it. Just like the mafia. Once you're in, you can't get out.
Well, and like you said, there's a bunch of rooms in that building. You can be in the business office or you can be in the back room, and you could probably stay out of the back room.
Yeah, I'm in the front office. Yeah, I'm the front office kind of guy. Yeah. We have some young men who they handle the back room quite well.
Yeah.
We let them stay back there.
That's good.
I want to be on the front office.
That advances the economic development for everybody.
Exactly.
Gives everybody a job. So what else? Now, I interrupted you, though. You were talking about something.
One idea I also have now is sort of culling together for a potential work, sort of looking at the civil rights movement in Durham. And so that's sort of one of the main pieces I have there. Also, I served on the Durham Honors Commission for the 150th anniversary. And so we only close out for the 150th anniversary here. And so November the 2nd, as you know, is the closeout date. And so we're looking forward to that. And also really just trying to collect and gather as much in the community as we can while it's still available, the papers, the richness of the papers in the community. And I would add not just the history and role of black funeral homes, but also, most importantly, the black church and also families. And that's driven largely by what scholars are telling us that they want to see. I thought, when we brought a group of scholars together, I said, well, what do you want? They said, we want more on African-Americans. We want more on African-American organizations and institutions. And that helps to drive me and wake up every morning looking for it.
Andre Van is on the lookout and going to provide that additional support, historical and otherwise. Andre Van is now the coordinator of University Archives at North Carolina Central University, also an instructor of public history there. And, of course, you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Andre, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
So glad to be here, Frank. Wonderful conversation.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things, produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall of Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. Josie Taras is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.